Welcome to the Beyond Jiu-Jitsu podcast. This is episode 150, our Q&A episode. Welcome, welcome. We haven't done one of these in a while because, you know, we took a break, but here we are. Let's get into some questions. I am Kieran Lefebvre and my co-host is Adam Childs.
It is indeed episode 150, our century and a half, if you will. So that's really cool. Yeah. You know, we do, for new listeners, we do these Q&A episodes every 10 episodes, but due to our break, you know, episode 140 was quite some time ago. So I'm excited to hear some viewer questions that some are recent, some would have been submitted from quite some time back. So we're going to try go in little air quotes off script in the sense of not how we usually rant and ramble for quite an extended period of time. We've done Q&As before where it's a whole hour episode and we answer like three questions or something. So we're going to try and get through as many questions as possible because, like we said, it's been a while since we've done one of these and there's a few questions that have been sitting there for quite some time. But we can't jump into it straight away. We need a little bit of a pre-episode, not banter, but conversation. Kieran, tell the people, what have you got on this weekend?
Nothing, bro. I'm just hanging out at home, doing the laundry. Shit. I don't do laundry.
So go on, something happening this weekend.
Yeah, little competition. We'll see how it goes. I'm hesitant to mention it because I haven't made weight yet. I just checked my weights.
Oh, haven't you?
No, my weight's a bit heavier than I thought. So the weight class, it's a submission. It's called submission wrestling. And it's just no-gi. It's just a no-gi comp. The rules are EBI, so submission only, EBI overtime. But there's only one EBI overtime. And the what's allowed and what's not allowed is a bit different. Think of like Grappling Industries-esque, like the old school Grappling Industries rules when they used to group it not by belt but by experience level. Yeah. And so it's so you can knee reap, there's knee bars, you can smother, like hand over mouth, tap people. You know, there's heaps of modified rules. And you can do twisters and shit, but whatever. Anyway,
can you do heel hooks?
No heel hooks. No heel hooks. Unless you're in the advanced and I chickened out and ended up just going my belt. Went intermediate. So that is this weekend on Saturday. So the day after this airs.
What are the weight divisions though? Are they quite, are they wacky weight divisions or?
Yeah, they're different. Mine's 83 kilos, which normally no-gi is 85 kilos. So it's a little bit lighter. I currently weigh, when I checked my weight at the gym after training, it was 84. So I'm not that far off. And yeah, but it just depends on how much water retention I have on the day. I'm not going to do any water cutting or anything like that. So I'm just going to like cross my fingers and hope for the best. So hopefully I make weight.
One kilo is not that big of a deal. And especially like, I don't even think you necessarily need to water cut that much to lose 1 kilo. But are you is your mindset like, you know, because I look at that situation and go, well, you know, either I'm going to commit to a bit more of an aggressive cut over the next 48 hours or something, or I'll just go up a weight division. But if you don't want to go up a weight division or do the water cut, is your sort of mindset a bit like, oh man, this, it's a bit of a novelty. Fuck, if I don't make weight, I don't give a shit. I'm just not going to do it.
100%.
Yeah.
my mentality is, fuck it. If I'm overweight, if I weigh in over, like, fuck it. Like if I weigh in, I'll see if I can get a photo of it, but they might not let me. But I think I'll probably be like 82 point something. So I'm gonna be at the top of my weight bracket or I'm gonna miss weight. And I'm okay with both of those scenarios. Like to be honest, I've only got four guys in my division. It's a super small local comp. Like, you know, the rule set is interests me, which is why I signed up pretty last minute. But I am gonna be doing this competition called Nordic. It's like Nordics. It's a big, air quotes, big competition in Sweden or in the Nordic region. And it's in October. So that's the one I'm actually, the whole gym goes to because, you know, it's run by someone that is in our team, I think. in the jiu-jitsu team that I'm a part of, the club. So it's the comp that everyone does. So I'm training for that properly. And it's IBJJF rule set, 88 kilos, I've already registered. So that's the one I'm like actually training for. So this one's just like, you know, I haven't competed since the start of the year. So it's like, hey, you know, haven't done a comp in a little while. Let's just get on the mats and feel some intensity and whatever.
Yeah. Oh, well, fingers crossed you make the weight. I mean, yeah. You know, if you miss it by, you know, 100 grams or something, that's pretty lame.
Let's take a shit.
Yeah,
let's go take a shit. Right. But, come back.
Yeah. But, you know, it's hard as well, because I often say to people when they're on the cusp of like a division or something, I go, well, man, sometimes it's, I mean, I guess to some degree, it's not making weight is always the fault to some degree of the competitor. But
yeah.
But sometimes it's not your fault in the sense to what I say to people is like, you know, they weigh themselves at the gym and they're like, oh, fuck, I need to lose this, or I'm on weight this or whatever. And I go, yeah, but, at the end of the day, man, what matters is, do you make weight on the scales that are at the competition? Like, because the scales you're currently standing on at my gym are essentially just bathroom scales that a lot of people have in small gyms or in, you know, whereas you go to an IBJJF competition, or maybe not every single IBJJF comp, but if you go to, let's for argument's sake, you go to Worlds or Pans or whatever. Okay, I don't know how accurate the scales are, but they're scales that are plugged into a computer, you know, and everything. So you assume they're pretty accurate scales or whatever. So if you've been making weight the whole time on your shitty bathroom scales that are off by 800 grams or something, you then might not make weight, you know? So typically these smaller competitions nowadays, with the growth of the sport, the last local competition we had here in Sydney that I went to did have scales that were plugged into a computer, into a laptop, you know, but usually these small little dinky competitions, it is just bathroom scales. And I think anyone who's stood on scales enough times over the years knows that one bathroom scales compared to another bathroom scales of the same brand from the same shop will be, you know, will fluctuate a little bit. So sometimes you miss weight by 100 grams and you might actually be on weight, but the scales you're standing on off a little bit. So
and that sucks.
Sometimes it goes the other way, man. Sometimes like I've been cutting weight for a competition thinking like, man, I'm not going to make weight. I've been, you know, whatever set of scales I'm using in the lead up to it, you know, I'm like, fuck, man, I'm really on the edge, you know? And then I weigh in and I weigh in like 3 kilos underweight. And I'm like, well, obviously the scales I was using were way off because I made weight easily. So I can go the other way too.
Yeah. The scales I've been using are at the gym and they're pretty legit. They're electronic scales, like a legit set. But they're, yeah, could be depends. Old. Who knows? Who fucking knows?
Yeah, again, doesn't depends. Does the comp have electronic scales or?
No idea. Yeah, I don't even know. I know like pretty much nothing about this competition. I know that it's a fucking 2-hour drive away. So if I miss weight, it's going to be a pain in the ass.
Yeah. Oh, well, fingers crossed.
But yeah, I'm carpooling and a bunch of other guys are competing. So I'm going to go watch regardless. And you know.
Sick. Nice.
Anyway.
All right, well, I got nothing to talk about my weekend this weekend, so let's get into it with question one.
Let's go.
Hey, Kieran and Adam. First, I just want to say thank you for making this awesome podcast. I've been listening for the past, I don't know, 50 or so episodes. I was just listening to your episodes on cardio recovery, and I was wondering if you have any tips for improving your speed in jiu-jitsu. I've been filming my rolls recently. I've noticed that in a lot of positions, my movement from position to position is really slow, even though overall from standing, I'm pretty explosive. And even in positions that I'm very comfortable in, I know really well, I still move very slowly. Are there any like drills or strategies you guys use to, you know, to make sure that you move quickly in these spots and to take advantage of any opportunities that sort of present themselves during the roll? Thanks again.
Thank you for the question. Interesting question, because I think we can answer it in two ways. So I think Kieran could answer it from more of a, you know, scientific strength, conditioning, mobility, movement way in terms of what are certain exercises and workouts that athletes do to increase their explosiveness and their agility. And, you know, you see like whatever, like, you know, NFL players and stuff do all these ladder footwork drills for agility. You see people do a lot of band work, lots of types of training, strength training and whatever you can do for explosiveness for that is workout specifically designed for speed and agility. So that would from a more physical point of view, but I don't know if that's exactly your question. So I'm going to answer it the other way. And I'm just going to kind of answer your question with a scenario and things that I do. Think about it like this. When you're training, when you're rewatching your footage, you've probably already come to this realization that when you watch yourself do a technique or a move in jiu-jitsu and you're realizing how slow it is, I say this to students sometimes. I go, man, you don't quite realize how fast professional athletes are or you know, if you want to think about it the other way, how slow you are. We're so used to watching professionals, the best guys in the world, right? Shoot these double legs or hit these sweeps or whatever. And so we associate like, you know, that's how fast we're doing it or whatever. You don't realize you're not. You don't realize how slow you are. And it's kind of the same as when you go do a sport that is just that you do once a year. Let's say maybe you go snowboarding and you get your friend to film you doing this jump and you're like, man, that was huge. And then you watch the footage back and you're like, meh. And you just do like the shittest little jump and it's so lame. So I've said to my students this, I said to them once, I was trying to get them to do things faster. And it was a double leg they were shooting. And I was trying to get them to shoot their double leg faster. Yes, there are strength exercises and workouts you can do to become a faster, more explosive human being, right? But also I believe there's value in like... How can you get better at shooting a double leg faster if you don't practice shooting a double leg as fast as you can shoot a double leg? You know, like a sprinter does workouts that build muscles and all this training to become a faster sprinter. But are you telling me that like Usain Bolt never does workouts where he runs 100 meters as fast as he humanly can? Of course he does, right? Like how are you going to get faster at executing a movement if you never practice it faster? How's a chef going to get faster at like, you know, dicing an onion if they never practice dicing an onion faster, right? And I said to them like this, I said, all right, imagine this. I said, I'm going to film you shooting a double leg and I want you to do it as fast as you can. Like, and when I mean as fast as you can, I mean, bro, gun to your head as fast as you can or you're gone. And I'll film you and you'll watch it back.
And then you pulled out a gun.
That's right, yeah. And I'm like, and then I guarantee you when you watch it back, you'll be shocked at how slow it is, you know? So with all that being said, what I do sometimes in my training is I try to execute my movements, whatever movement technique I'm doing. I literally say to myself, when I go for this, I'm going to go for it as fast as possible. So when I do this arm drag, I'm literally when I say as fast as possible, the same way I might be doing a one rep max deadlift. Like I'm physically going to do this as fast as possible. And because people don't often really do that, right? You know, like the same way you might sometimes when you're digging deep to submit someone, squeeze a rear naked choke physically as hard as you can squeeze it. Like I'm going to sit up literally as fast as I can. I'm going to shoot literally as fast as I can. Right. So I'm live practicing executing something as fast as I can in a role. And you'd be surprised. You're not going to necessarily come across as spazzy because realistically, if you watch that, it's still going to be super slow. So that's something I do in my training. I think that was more where your question was going, but obviously Kieran would have more of an insight in terms of workouts you can do to become a faster, more explosive, agile athlete.
So from a strength and conditioning perspective, when it comes to training explosively, it's similar to what you were talking about, Adam. you want to add in the element of speed. So things that I like to include will be speed movements, like speed deadlifts is a great exercise. Adding variable resistance, and even you mentioned this at the start, Adam, the bands, adding bands and chains can help with explosive training as well, and power training, if you will. We can also do plyometrics. Plyometrics is something that I always include in a program that has an element of power or speed, if you will. Things like box jumps are the traditional ones, but you can do broad jumps. Kneeling to vertical jump is a great one, where you start on your knees and then you pop up as quick as you can to a vertical jump. It's a fun little exercise that I like to include and works the lower body.
So what do you mean by that? So you're on your knees and you jump to your feet as if you were standing up in closed guard, but then you do a jump.
Yeah, then you vertical jump.
So it's
two
jumps, sort of, you mean. You got to jump to your feet and then jump.
Yep. Okay, exactly. Gotcha. And then you can do another variation where it's the same, but then you add the broad jump in, which is a great, and as you just identified, not all strength and conditioning exercises that are good for jiu-jitsu look like jiu-jitsu movements. And a lot of the times, the ones that do look like jiu-jitsu movements are the shittier ones to do, which upsets a lot of people, which is ironic. But you identified that this particular exercise looks like popping up in a close guard, particularly in no-gi, right? So it has some application there that is readily apparent to everyone seeing that movement. For the upper body, movements that I like, again, anything that you're lifting explosively, obviously doing it safely with correct form, but things like a landmine jerk or jerks in general, Olympic lifts can be good for explosive power, but the reason I don't want to go in a rabbit hole, but I don't program Olympic lifts at all in my programs, and I have very good reasons for that. But yeah, there's so many other movements. But basically, if you want to think about how to incorporate training more explosively without following a power program, you can add in, I would start with adding in plyometric supersets at the end of your workouts. I'm assuming that you already do work out. Say you work out twice per week, at the end of your sessions, add in a superset. So find two plyometric exercises, one for the upper body, one for the lower body, and do 10 reps of each for 4 rounds. No rest in between, ideally. Or if your fitness level isn't quite there, then add 30 to 60 seconds of rest in between each round. So a good one that I like is very simple. Box jumps and kettlebell swings. Both power movements, both explosive movements. One's plyometrics and one is not, but still, the point stands. Or you can do the vertical jump exercise I just mentioned. Or you can do broad jump. Or you can do single leg hopping, or you could do sideways hopping, or jumps, if you will. You could do weighted squat jumps. There's so many different variations. And the same with upper body. You can do explosive push-ups. You can do the landmine jerk, anything like that. Adam in as a superset, and that would really help. If you want a dedicated strength and power program, then I do have one available. I called it Beast Mode. Appropriate name, and it's available on bjjstrongonline.com.
Nice.
Self-plug.
Yeah, as I said, you know, Kieran's got the you know, in terms of workouts to improve that, in terms of it, you know, my answer to the question is in terms of improving on that in terms of in your roles, you just got to practice doing it faster. Yeah, so sometimes I'll realize that I'm being a bit lazy or slow, and I'll say to myself, like, nah, man, like, you know, sometimes when, you know, Mike Tyson is throwing a punch, like, he's throwing that punch literally as hard as he physically can throw that punch. Obviously not every punch. I mean, it's a bit different boxing. That's not every punch is 100%, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In my training, sometimes I'll be like, this is 110% effort on this particular movement. Fast, hard as I can do it.
The way I like to practice my like speed double legs as fast and hard as possible is to be like safer for me. I like to pick someone that's at least 30 kilos lighter. So
that's right.
So women and children are great targets.
Yeah, yeah, that's
anyway,
right.
Terrible joke. Anyway, thanks for the question, Basha. All right, let's go to question number 2 from Aaron.
Hey, lads. Really missing the podcast. Kieran, just first of all, wanted to say congratulations on the wedding, mate. Hope it was a beautiful day. Adam, hope you're enjoying your move. Question here is for Kieran. Now that you moved to a new country, new gym, how have you found the theme of the training you're at, how it differs from the theme that you may have been learning with Adam here in Australia? And has that changed your game or your approach in any way? Keen for you guys to get back on air and start listening and learning a lot more from you, but hope you all have been great. Cheers and talk soon.
Awesome question.
Like, it is obviously above and beyond anything I've ever experienced before.
Literally beyond jiu-jitsu. Okay, so when I first got here, for the first 3 months, the gym was just doing open mat sessions, like open training, open sparring, because it was summer. And, you know, in particularly Northern Europe, summer is a big deal because it's the only time the sun comes out in this part of the world. So, you know, people go nuts and everything shuts down. So all coaching was ceased and it was just open mat training if you wanted to show up. And yeah, so we only just got back into regular teaching. And what I've realized is I haven't been told this, but I think they go with themes. So they'll not necessarily just do arm bars for a month or whatever, but it seems to be themes. Like, because I've noticed similar sort of techniques are being shown each session. And mind you, there's only two or three sessions per week, two gi, one no gi. And it seems to be very similar things being taught. But the class structure is completely different. And this is where I wanted to talk about. I'll be super quick. In Sydney, Adam, your classes, it follows a structure. So it's warm-up, technique, rolling, right?
As a basic structure, obviously. As a base, there's lots of different ways that I run a class, but
I'm trying not to simplify it.
Yeah, that would be your cookie cutter standard, nothing special going on here class. Yeah.
Sometimes you do reverse classes where you'll do technique at the end based on questions. There's lots of different things, but the standard jiu-jitsu structure that most people are familiar with is the warm-up, technique. Obviously, you drill the technique or whatever, maybe do some specific rounds and then go into rolling. So in an hour and a half class, you would probably do how many minutes of rolling would you do in an hour and a half?
If I was to average it.
Yeah, average.
Let's say 45 minutes.
I agree. Something some like 60, that. Some are 45, you know, depending on the
some
on the
are
session.
30, you know, but yeah, averaging it out.
Yeah, yeah. You probably wouldn't do less than 30 minutes in an hour and a half rolling.
Almost never.
Yeah. So at the gym that I'm currently at, because it's just started, we have a lot of new people, blah, blah, blah. The classes are a bit slower. So it would be the warm-up and like flow roll. So they generally split into the white belts and whatever go on to one half of the mat and the non-white belts. Do whatever. It's basically two classes going at the same time, if you will. And then what happens is we do like a flow roll, we do a couple rounds, blah, blah, blah. So the warm-up and flow roll is like the first half hour gone. And then we do technique. It will be like after the flow roll, we do like show some techniques and then we might flow roll again and then go back to technique. And then we might have an actual roll, like a, you know, a 80% roll and then go back to technique. So it's really interesting that it's kind of like, you know, maybe one or two rounds of rolling and then we're back to technique when I would normally be like, okay, for the rest of the class, the last 45 minutes is rolling. But then we do more technique and then a couple rounds. And then the rounds are usually pretty short. So basically what I'm saying is the class structure is a lot different. And I'd say the average amount of rolling that we get per hour and a half class is about 12 minutes, which, yes, it's the start of the season, if you will, the start of the semester, as they call it, because they kind of structure it like school semesters. It's the start of the semester. So things are amping up. But for me, I get a little bit frustrated with that class structure. I'm just going to be honest, I'm just putting it out there. I'd prefer to do 45 to 60 minutes of rolling in an hour and a half. No offense to my training partners, but I've had many sessions where, you know, it's rolling time. I go get a sip of water, I turn around, and like I'm partnered up with someone that's much, much lighter than me. So I have a very easy roll. Or maybe it's like a, you know, a white belt that's 50 kilos. You know, and I'm like, okay, so I've got an easy roll for 5 minutes or whatever. And then the next round is the same thing. You know, just so happens that I get a easier partner and I only get one actual fucking round in. And that's frustrating for me. But, you know, obviously I can't complain. because I'm a visitor at the gym, and it sounds like I'm bitching, but that's the biggest difference.
Yeah, I mean, you ought to work with what you got, but yeah, it's an interesting class structure or interesting theme. But I've never trained in a gym that functioned like that. But
yeah,
but I did train once at a gym that was a structure I didn't vibe with. It was like hour and a half classes, and after the warm up, it was like, man, you think that like. What you're saying is still like, okay, like, you know, it's just a different approach. It's fine. You know, and whether you have hard roles or not, I mean, that's just going to vary on your skill level and your partners and whatever. But
yeah.
At least it's still a jiu-jitsu class happening. I used to train. Yeah. I visited this gym for a little while post moving back from Brazil. And it was an hour and a half class. And you would have, after the warm-up and technique, you would have maybe like 5 to 10 minutes of the class left, and you would do 2 or 3 3-minute rounds.
Damn.
And that was, and I was like, this is so shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah.
But anyway, that's yeah. Thank you for the question. I guess that's the current theme of how Kieran's training. Let us go on to question 3.
What's up, Adam and Kieran? This is Dylan coming at you hot from New Zealand, or Kiwiland, as Kieran knows it. Loved sending that pink belt over. Sorry I didn't get it over there sooner so that Kieran could take it, but it probably would have ended up in a airport bin so that he could take a bunch of shampoo with him. Nice move there. Shout out to Nick P. I'm going to pass your guard next time I see you because, you know, I'm just better in every way. Genetically, better looking. I don't earn as much as you, but hey, look, it's about me passing your guard. It's those points that I'm here for. What we do at our gym, oh yeah, this is a question, I'll get to it. In our gym, to keep it fun, we've got a tie-dye belt, and if the tie-dye belt guy submits you, you get the belt, and then you, at the end of the month, if you can't get rid of it, you have a half-hour Shark Tank. Now, we haven't quite followed through with it yet, because we're jiu-jitsu people, we don't like to keep track of stuff. We like to forget about things periodically and keep everyone on their toes about whether we're actually mentally alive. But I thought that could be a good idea until Kieran can recover that pink belt and take it back, or, you know, take ownership of his delightful new colors. All right, guys, peace. I don't know what the question actually was, but I'm sure you'll have some good content out of this. Thanks, fellas. Bye.
Well, man. Dylan. We too do not know what the question was.
We need a translator from Kiwi to Australian.
Yeah, but I guess for everyone else, I'll just provide context because I guess it's not really a question to answer. I'm happy to. Thank you for submitting it, Dylan, because it was hilarious. And man, hopefully things still happen. For next year, Dylan and I have been chatting a little bit to maybe go over to New Zealand for a seminar next year. So fingers crossed we can make that happen. But so Dylan sent Kieran a pink belt, which I don't know what the original purpose for it was. But anyway,
I said I wanted one.
Oh, okay. It arrived after Kieran had already gone to Sweden. And so he sent it to the gym, because he didn't have Kieran's address. He just sent it to the gym's address. So I received it and I was like, bro, I'm not posting this over to Sweden for you. And Kieran's like, don't worry about it. I'll get it. Just leave it in the gym. I'll get it when I get back. And then, so now it's being used in the gym the same way that we had a pink belt in my gym in Brazil. That was just like the extra belt that was left hanging in the gym for if you ever rocked up to class and you forgot your belt, it was like, well, pink belt's there, put that on.
Yeah.
And yeah, you'd see black belts sometimes even who forgot their belt and they'd be like, ah, shit, gotta wear the pink belt. Yeah. So now it sits in our gym serving that purpose.
Yeah.
But yeah, the tie-dye thing's pretty funny. Like that's interesting awesome. Concept to have some sort of like king of the hill, or I don't know if he was explaining it as in you're like king of the mats or like bottom of the mats. Like, is it a good thing having the tie-dye belt or a bad thing? I didn't quite understand, but
I think I understood it. If you submit someone who's wearing the tie-dye belt, you then take the belt off them. And then at the end of the month, you're rewarded with a 30-minute Shark Tank.
Right. So, yeah. So it's essentially like, if you're good enough, you have the belt at the end, and then
yeah, then you get
if, and then if you then you get Shark Tank. But then maybe if you survive the Shark Tank, the team pays for your acai or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that sounds good.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah. You bloody rascal.
On to question four.
Thank you. Let's go.
Hello, Adam here from the old South Wales. I'm a blue belt hobbyist. I train about 6 times a week. And after 3 of those sessions is open mat. So usually we get an hour of rolling 3 times a week on top of any extra lessons or positional sparring or whatever. So just an hour of open mat just to roll. I've been trying to spend the open mats doing every single round, trying to get 10 rounds in, use technique, use my cardio, be efficient with my moves so that I'm able to last to the next round and do 10 rounds on the row. I find that's been working for me. Obviously, it's improved my jiu-jitsu loads. I feel amazing. When we actually get to play the game of jiu-jitsu with people, I'm doing really well. But I entered a competition the other day, a blue belt competition, and found I got beat by the intensity of people. No one was willing to play guard or play the game. Everyone was just coming, running at you 100 miles an hour, sticking their head in your face like you'd expect. So my question is it best for me to carry on just trying to hone my techniques, do every round, make sure that I can survive for 10 rounds in a row? Or would it be better for me to start when we lead up to a competition, going absolutely flat out for one round, having a round off, flat out again for another round off, which more simulates what you will do in a competition? I feel like everybody thinks you should just do the 10 rounds straight through because you need to prove how efficient you are. But obviously I'm not practicing being intense then, which I would like to. So please let me know.
Awesome. Thanks for the question, Adam.
Yeah, good question. So I've seen this multiple times. When people go in for their first competition, no matter how much I try to prepare my students for that, they're not ready for the intensity of competition, right? And the adrenaline dump of competition and all that. In very short, to answer your question, it's the saying, whatever the expression is, there's multiple variations of it, but, you fight how you train, or, you train so hard that the fight becomes easy or whatever. So you can't, I don't want to open a can of worms, because you can't train hard competition rounds every single time you step on the mats. Like, it's very punishing for the body. And being a hobbyist, I'm assuming you're not taking anabolic steroids to allow you to do things beyond what's, the average person can do. Like, it's very rough on the body to train like competition rounds every single time you're on the mats. But in terms of like me as a, if you're preparing for a competition, especially, man, you have to practice the intensity. Like, you can't replicate it at all. We've done episodes and episodes recently where Kieran's spoken a lot about, like, and he's got YouTube videos on it that talk about doing jiu-jitsu doesn't improve your cardio for jiu-jitsu or whatever, talking about the ceiling of how much you can improve your VO2 max and all these sorts of things. So there's that side of it, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about, there's workouts you can do to improve your cardio for jiu-jitsu better than you can by doing jiu-jitsu. Yes. But there is not a single thing in the world that you can do that replicates like the intensity, the resistance, the timing, and all the things of actually fucking training jiu-jitsu at an intense level. So if you're preparing for a comp, I would prefer, if let's say I was overlooking your training, Adam, and I've got you who efficiently finished the 10 rounds, and I've got that student who went all in every single round, but at round 7 he puked, I'm way more impressed by that dude. It's so whether it's go hard every round, then have a rest round, or whether it's go hard every round until you can't do anymore, that's up to you. Obviously, not every time you step on the mats needs to be that. But like leading up to a comp, it's you just, yes, there's complementary training you can do, but you just mm-hmm. can't replicate it. Like there's, you know, like if you imagine like, you know, surfing 6 foot waves being training and then big wave surfing being the competition, there's nothing you can do to replicate the intensity of what happens riding a big wave other than fucking riding a big wave.
Agreed.
You know, like, so yes, there's a lot of complementary things you can do. Do this to get faster, do this to, you know, be more efficient, this to have better cardio, all these things. But as a whole package, like you've got to do the thing that you're doing.
No, so, I agree with you. And I think there's two different things here, right? So I don't think Adam's issue is he's gassing out. I think his issue is he's being overwhelmed by the aggression and intensity that he's not used to, which plays into exactly what you're talking about. Now, if he can match aggression with aggression, but he's not lasting as long as his opponent and he's gassing out, then we can talk about VO2 max training. We can talk about aerobic-based training. But if you're just being overwhelmed by people, like you said, getting their head into your face and just fucking like trying to murder you, and you're not used to that, like as you said, because in jiu-jitsu training, your training partners respect you and, you know, we're not going easy, but we're being respectful. Like you're not going to drop your forearm into someone's neck for like a, you know, to get them to open their guard or what, you know what I mean? Like, There's levels, right? So I think,
but in competition, that's not always the case, right? Like as a whole, jiu-jitsu is more, in little air quotes, friendly and respectful than, you know, some other martial arts. But I try to get this through the head of my students as well. I'm like, guys, it is at a competitive level or a professional level. So maybe your average little dinky rural competition, it's going to be, you know, especially if you're an older guy as well, maybe you're fighting in masters, it might be a little bit more sort of friendly, easygoing. But as a whole, it still is a full contact combat sport. So as long as people are operating within the rules, the things that they're doing, they're allowed to do as hard and fast as they want, you know? Yeah. So someone is allowed to snap on an armbar as quick as they want. There's nothing, you know, the same way, again, I said this earlier in the episode about boxing, the same way a boxer is allowed to punch you in the face as hard as they physically, humanly, possibly can. Jiu-jitsu is the same. As long as it's within the rules, bro. Okay, I'm not allowed to spike tackle you, right? But I'm allowed to, like, you know, essentially double leg you and, like, or you're not allowed to do over the back suplexes like we think about in jiu-jitsu, but you can do, like, let's just call it a mini suplex. I'm allowed to do that and drop you as hard as I want, you know. I'm allowed to knee on belly you, trying to make my knee rupture your spleen. It's all within the rules, right? So it's a full contact physical combat sport. So yeah, you got to get on board with the aggression. As long as you're operating within the rules, you're allowed to snap down as hard as you want. You're allowed to, you know, all these things. Yeah. And you see it, sometimes it gets a bit heated in the recent quintet, you know, in Japan. That was the one that you know, the B team were fighting with Polaris team, 10th Planet and Sakuraba. And man, some of the fights got super sort of like shovey and pushy and like almost a bit brawly, you know, so... Yeah, man, you gotta get on board with the intensity, and you can't do every role like that, but you gotta get in the mindset for it.
Definitely
coming comp time for sure.
My last competition, it was a no-gi match, and we both me and my opponent got a warning from the ref because we're being too aggressive, and with our snap downs and our grabbing for the head, we're just like slapping each other and like whoa, settle down, boys. Like, it was getting really heated.
One of my good friends who I've mentioned before, Ali Monferrati is his name. We had a very similar black belt journey together in Brazil, very similar histories that we followed. And yeah, although Ali was always a more active and successful competitor than I was, still competes to this day. He's a bit younger than me. Not that that's an excuse, but he still competes. And he has his own gym in Bahrain called Elements Jiu-Jitsu. He's currently preparing for the I think it's the Abu Dhabi World Pro competition. But he, I think it was back at Purple Belt or something. I can't remember if he might have even been DQ'd. I'm now starting to like kind of, you know when you, I think, forget there's a term for it when, you know, have memories and warp over time and, stories change. Because I might be confusing with when Cyborg got DQ'd for it against Gordon, but I'm 99% sure Ali got DQ'd for that. He was like really aggressively like snapping down and slapping. And
yeah.
So yeah, you got that fine line between it being a strike and not a strike, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Long story short, man, you got to get on board with the aggression side of it and do some aggressive roles and
100%.
But when that's with your training partners in context, right? Don't grab the dude who's 40 kilos lighter than you, two belts below you, and you're like, it's fucking smash time. take it case by case basis, but yeah, for sure. And
I think just one last thing, in order to prepare for it, nothing I've found is better than actually doing comp roles with people in your gym that compete as well. There's nothing better. Nothing better.
Yep. And you can do other things to replicate it. You would be surprised how much this, to some degree, replicates the competition, where if you have an instructor run a class where when it comes to the roles, only you and the other person are rolling and the whole class is watching you and the coach is counting the points. You'd be surprised, even though it's like no different to when you maybe roll that person every day that you train, but all of a sudden everyone's watching you and the coach is counting the points. You know, you'd be surprised. All of us, you have this little like, you know, a tiny adrenaline dump happen, and it becomes real all of a sudden.
Yeah,
you'd be surprised how much that can add to replicating and preparing.
All right, let's go to the next question from Disco Stew.
Hey, gents, big fan of the podcast. I just wanted to send a question to ask if, what's your opinion on BJJ dummies, you know, to work on at home in between classes? Are they good for improving? Or a complete waste of time? Thanks very much. Big fan. Saludos desde Madrid. Take care. Bye.
All right. So, BJJ dummies. What are your thoughts on the jiu-jitsu dummies?
It's a good question, but I'll just quite openly say that I would be answering it from a less educated point of view. And what I mean by that is I'm not going to like arrogantly, I mean, I have my opinion, but I'm going to openly say that my opinion is not coming from a super educated position, because during my progression years of jiu-jitsu, or, you know, I like to think I'm still progressing. It's the never ending pursuit with jiu-jitsu. But during that bulk progression phase, let's just call blue to black belt or whatever for argument's sake, but dummies weren't a thing, and I just had real life drilling partners that I would drill with. So I'm not sitting here from a position of like, oh, I did live drilling with partners for 3 years and I did a couple of years of drilling with dummies. Like, so I don't have that educated point of view to give my opinion from. However, you know, I've spoken to lots of people who have quite expensive grappling dummies, and they're like, oh man, you can do quite a lot with them, you know. But I guess at the end of the day, they're limited in the sense that they make me think about practicing playing tennis against a wall. I'm like, yeah, the dummy does nothing but offer you, you know, something tangible to move around, but there's, as soon as you want something, a little bit of variability or a little bit of resistance, or as soon as you want to drill something that requires, like, you know, you want to drill multiple step sequences of, okay, like I'm going for this, but then you defend in this way, so I need to transition to this. Well, you can't drill any of that stuff with a dummy, because a dummy can't do that, right? You can't even drill sort of like live resistance drilling, of course, you know, because a dummy can't do that. So they're fine tools to go through movements. But then, you know, similar to, I guess, how you see MMA fighters use a boxing bag lying on the ground to transition from side control, ground and pound, and over to this side and ground and pound. Like, it's an object that you can use to practice movements, but my opinion is they're pretty limited in developing muscle memory for more complicated techniques and things like that. But again, I've never really spent time using them.
Only thing I would say is I've, my opinion on drilling in general is that I'm still not convinced that drilling with limited resistance from your training partner is useless. I'm not sure, but I think
that, I never said that, to be clear.
No. I'm saying this.
Right.
I know you definitely believe in the power of drilling without resistance, and I'm saying that I don't really think that it's super effective, but I'm not quite sure where I land on that argument at the moment. I'm still like, you know, I need more time to consider, ponder, blah, blah, blah. But I will say that I am a much bigger fan, and I think it's much more valuable doing drilling, air quote drilling, more like a specific training style, meaning like, hey, let's drill this position. This is the objective. Let's add resistance. So what I'm saying is I prefer to do a couple of reps just to learn the movement pattern, recognize what I'm going for, and then say to my training partner, okay, let's up the resistance. Give me your resistance now, and learn the movement that way. Learn the pattern that way. And I prefer that. Now, you obviously can't do that with a dummy, but just because you can't do that with a dummy, does that mean the dummy is useless? I don't know. I'm not sure, but I've never used a grappling dummy, so I don't know what I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're on the same point. They're useful for learning the movement, right? But yeah, because when I say that, I find it so ridiculous that people say that drilling with zero resistance is a waste of time, because it's like, well, it's John Danaher in a video I watched at some point, hammered it home perfect. He's like, oh, it's not useless. It just has a very low ceiling on your time spent versus like your return on investment. But like, obviously drilling with zero resistance has value, because if I'm teaching you a movement that you can't even do, when not only am I giving you zero resistance, but you don't have the coordination, the skill yet or whatever, you can't even do the technique I'm trying to teach you, when I'm not only not resisting, I'm actually trying to help you do it, and you still can't do it. What, I'm going to jump to you doing it with resistance is ridiculous. You know, like, man, going from never having ever tried a bearing bolo, and then just being like, Kieran, this is like, let me demo one and now do it with resistance. It's fucking ridiculous, because people spend ages not being able to do one against anyone, let alone someone who's adding resistance. So once you learn the movement pattern, then in my opinion, resistance becomes a valuable tool. But like, if you can't even execute it yet, like...
That's assuming that knowledge is required for movement. You know what I mean? Like that you need for skill acquisition, rather, that you need the knowledge first and then the skill comes later. But that is opening a can of worms. I don't want
to. It is. But let me ask one question though.
Let's not.
No. Because I'm just curious. If
go on.
So coming from Australia, you've seen this image countless times, right? Let's say you have a student they're at a learn to surf school, and they can't even pop up onto the board that's stationary on the sand. And be like, don't worry about it, bro. Like, that's not how it actually happens. Paddle out and you'll, you know, do it out as you're dropping in on a wave. You'll be like, bro, like if you don't even have the skill and coordination to pop up on a stationary board on the sand, it is very unlikely you're going to find the skill to do it catching a wave.
I don't know. I think it would maybe, it might be more valuable for them to spend that time trying to pop up in the ocean, because you could get really good at popping up on a surfboard in the sand, but that is not what it is on the water, because the surfboard is moving. So you can have someone that can pop up bloody with one arm, one leg blindfolded on the sand, but get them out on the dynamic movement of the actual board in the water, and they can't do it. So what that argument would be is your drilling time on a static object, a static person, does not translate to actually executing the move in jiu-jitsu, because every single rep is different. Every time is different. Yeah,
but my popping up on the surfboard on the sand, do you know how many repetitions I would do of that? Exactly one. Oh, yeah, cool. Paddle out. You know, like, it's not something I need to drill. So if the surfboard on the sand is the grappling dummy is useful for one repetition. and then I don't need it. Now I'm going out to do it in the variable ocean, what it's actually like, you know?
Yeah. See, this is where I have it.
Don't worry, little Jimmy. Bikes don't actually have training wheels, so off you go, you know, like.
Whoa, that's Scarecrow. That's the Scarecrow. Okay, so, and this is where I'm not sure if I'm 100%, and obviously for those that don't know, we're arguing about ecological training. Let's just call out the elephant in the room. And I'm not sure if, I don't know. I'm still wrestling with this concept. I don't know if doing drilling completely is useless, at least to learn complex, or to see and recognize complex patterns. But yeah, I'm not sure. I definitely think, and this is the last thing I'll say, and then obviously I'll hand it back to you, and then we'll close out. I definitely think that over the last 3 months at least, my opinion on drilling in general has changed a lot, and I see way less value in it than I used to provide it. I used to think that if I drilled for an hour a day, I'd get so much better at jiu-jitsu. Now I think if I did that, I would probably maybe be wasting my time a little bit. And I think, yeah, my value that I've put on drilling has diminished down to the level where I don't see it as completely useless. I still see value in it, but I don't know if I'm going to see value in it for, you know, moving forward. I don't know yet.
I think as well, one of the big issues with this conversation as a whole is that just the fact that the term drilling is so broad, you know, like,
exactly.
So we'll go back to one of the previous questions about doing things fast. Well, what if I'm drilling how fast I can shoot double legs, right? I'm working on how quickly I can do, like, there's no way I'm going to get better at shooting double legs faster without putting in reps of shooting double legs super fast, you know?
But Adam, what is a double leg?
Yeah.
A double leg does not exist.
So one of my favorite no-gi passes is a blast knee cut, right? And so I like drilling that. Like, I'm just going for reps. Not reps, it's not, but like every single rep is like, if it was sprints, right? Every rep is I'm trying to hit my PB of my 100-meter sprint.
Is your partner giving resistance? Are they trying to stop you? Or are they letting you do it?
No. They're just letting me do it, right? So, like, in that regard, they could be a grappling buddy.
I don't know. I'm not sure I see value in that anymore.
How are you going to get faster at doing a skill that requires 99% of the skill is speed? How are you going to get faster at it if you never put in rounds of doing it fast?
Well, you can do rounds of doing it fast, but what I'm saying is instead...
Isn't that a type of drill?
That goes to your point.
So that's what I'm saying. It's the vagueness of the term drilling.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying.
Let's replace, in my opinion, I would replace the term drilling with games. Triggered. But if we replace the term drilling, if what I would do with your knee cut thing, and obviously this is a blue belt telling a black belt, so take this obviously with a grain of salt, but the new thought process that I'm about now is instead of doing the speed blast doubles, I would do the speed blast doubles with a resistance partner. And you can put yourself in positions progressively moving toward your end result being the knee cut, right? So that's where we talk about the staging of setting up the position and going from there. And then once the conclusion has been met, then we restart. So it's the concept of pass, sweep, or submit, but dissecting it a little bit further. And I really think there is some value in that, because you're spending more time in the actual position doing the actual jiu-jitsu, right? You're spending way more time with a live opponent, which is actually jiu-jitsu, rather than getting speed with that movement pattern, which could be beneficial. But I'm saying that if you have a resistance partner, you're getting best of both worlds. That's the only thing I'd say.
Yeah. But I just I completely agree. I honestly think this video I watched a while back, I can't even remember what it's titled. Yeah, John Danaher explains it perfectly, in my opinion, that like our current, what most people understand as drilling, is only useful until a certain point. And I think anyone who tells you it's not, it's a flat out waste of time no matter what, I honestly think is so ignorant, because I've seen students who are absurdly uncoordinated, who when doing something with a non-resisting partner, despite them being shown the technique once a week over the last 6 weeks, still confuse their left and right, or still go the wrong way, or still put the wrong foot in the wrong spot. And I've seen people with a zero resistance training partner still hurt themselves or their partner, because they still can't do it. You know, they're still putting their right foot where their left foot should be, which equals a ruptured ACL or whatever. And it's like, the last thing I want to do is put this dude into a scenario with resistance and then someone's breaking something. You know, I think if you can't even, yeah, like, I don't know. I just think I don't know, man. I know we're getting into a whole different thing, but I just can't get on board with being like, there's, you know, to think that there's no value in just at least, like, you know, fuck, do it, like, at least learning how to control your body and move your body. Like, man, I've got students who are still like white belts of 6 months who when you tell them to shoot, they still drive the wrong knee to the ground and essentially just do a lunge. And it's like, after 6 months of training, you're like, how do you still do this incorrectly, bro? You know?
But then the argument would be, and
they're not doing it in a live environment. Well, yeah, that's such a,
but how can you shoot when there's no one in front of you to shoot on? You know what I mean? Like, how many, when you shoot for a double leg or a single leg or whatever, you know, when your objective is to lower your base level and penetrate into your opponent's hips, legs, etc., to return them to the mat, to take them down, right? How can you do that when there's no one in front of you, because it looks different every single time you do it? And I think it's interesting, because one thing, an analogy or a concept that opened my eyes to this, is there was this study, and you're going to hate this, but basically they took a bunch of tennis players, right? And they looked at dissecting the tennis player's serve. And they found that if they tried to reconstruct a tennis player's serve, you would assume that it looks the same every single time. If you're drilling, and this is the analogy we can put to drilling, right? If you have a tennis player and they're serving, you would assume that it looks the same every single time. So therefore, you could deconstruct each individual component biomechanically and replicate the perfect serve. And what they found is it doesn't work that way, because there's micro compensations between every single joint, because it's an incredibly complex movement. If we apply that to jiu-jitsu, the same can be said, right? Like, if you're trying to shoot a double leg, you will never shoot a double leg the way we do in lights. Like, you just fucking won't. Like, that is not what the movement pattern looks like. When there's someone in front of you shooting a double leg, looks completely different every single time. So the point is that by trying to learn the mechanical repetition of shooting the double leg is a waste of time, because you're never actually going to do that movement. That's the argument for ecological approach. Yeah.
My counter argument would be that those variables that you can't replicate the serve every single time would be, like, there's certain variables that wouldn't matter as long as it operates within certain parameters, like it's functionable. But then, like, you've also, I think, you know, man, there's also the real world application of it. Like, do you have, if I asked you not to name anyone, but if I asked you to think, like, oh, Kieran, can you think of a training partner you've had in your time who's absurdly spazzy and that injures everyone or whatever. Have you had one of those training partners yet that's spazzy and you don't trust much?
Definitely.
Okay. So now, Kieran, you're partnered with that person and he's digging inside heel hooks on you and you've got to give resistance. Like, how do you feel about that scenario going? Do Do you feel totally on board with partnering up with that person and adding resistance while they inside heel hook you against the spazzy dude who hurts everyone?
I think this feels like a scarecrow. This feels
no,
like...
No, it is a legitimate application that could happen in this sort of, like, this is coming. This is a guy who has never been given the opportunity to, like, at least learn the movements and go through it because it's a waste of time. He was never even allowed that one pop-up on the surfboard on the sand. Now he's partnered with you. You've got to give him resistance for heel hooks.
So you wouldn't start in that position, right? You would progress the position in a
I don't know. But I think I get the point you're making. If you look at the real world application of it as a whole, you might go, well, like, even if it's the best, it's the new best thing. I mean, it in itself has to have limitations, and that would be one very real world limitation, you know, you know, take that to more complicated techniques that I know everyone hates, but like things like jumping clothes guard or whatever, it's still within the rules, right? Mm. Jumping clothes guard, so it's not illegal yet. It's not illegal yet. So what if you're then, I don't know. I just think it's,
And that's where, anyway. And that's the point where I haven't been fully convinced yet. I'm not sure, but I'm definitely... I think both what I'm okay. I know like 10 minutes ago we said we'll stop, but I think what I've discovered is I definitely think that there is 100% think that there's value in this approach. I think that
There's value. Exactly. I think there's value in it too. I never said there wasn't. I just don't think there's value in doing it exclusively.
That's fair enough.
Because fuck, there's no way that I'm drilling, let's say, you're drilling, little air quotes, whatever you want to call it, resistance training, drilling with limited resistance, whatever. There's no way I'm doing a technique where, let's say the technique is I've shot a double, they've wrapped the guillotine and then jumped to close guard. There's no way I'm drilling that with someone who I don't completely trust, because I'm not running that risk of getting spiked and having my neck broken. Mm. You know, there's no way. Like, there's a lot of techniques that I would not touch with a 10-foot pole against someone with resistance drilling who I don't trust completely. You know, and so I think, anyway, it's fucking, here we are talking about this. But let me give an analogy that maybe, whether you agree or not, we can just leave this as the little like bow that ties up this package. I heard, so this isn't my analogy. Someone said this today and I think it's fucking perfect. He goes, If jiu-jitsu were music, it would be jazz. And I was like, that's so perfect, like, because it's so variable and it's so rant and it's never the same twice, but there's certain rules, right, that you need to follow, but it's so, at the same time, you know, I think he said, to be more accurate, I think he said, jiu-jitsu's the jazz of the martial arts or something like that. And I was like, I'd never thought about it like that, because it is so sort of, you know, if you're not in it, you can't understand it, and like the timing's all weird and it's never the same twice, but somehow everyone knows what's going on. And
yeah, that's fair.
I don't know,
all right, you ready?
Find that John Danaher video, people, watch that. I think he explains it way better than I do. That either of us do, you know.
Yeah. All right, next question is from Xavier.
Question about training with an injury. I had a surgery about 9 weeks ago for a broken foot, and I'm about 3 weeks from fully recovering for the bone. But I also have been training for about 3 weeks for strength and conditioning on that leg again. So my question is, you know, your advice to hopping back on the mats. I basically want to get back in there and drill as soon as I can, but I'd like to hear what you guys think.
This is ironic because we just spent like, 30 minutes arguing about drilling, and now we're being asked if he should drill.
Well, hey, look, again, like that's what I'm saying. Anyone who says there's no value in it, well, yeah, exactly that. What if it's someone coming back from injury and they're like, bro, I want no resistance. I'm just getting back on the mats. I just want to move my body. Like, man, you're telling me that's, if, if that's a waste, if the alternative is doing zero jiu-jitsu, you're going to tell me that's a waste of time? You know, yeah, I'm just coming back from a full torn ACL. Let's drill leg entanglements with resistance. Nah, bro, I'm all good. I'd rather not. But I
you
would still
do that though. If you're coming back from an ACL injury, you wanted to do an ecological approach, you wouldn't fucking put yourself in leg entanglement. That's dumb.
Well, man, it might not be up to you. You're just a student at the gym, right?
Then you say, I'm not doing it.
Like, yeah, well, I guess I don't get to train today, you know. Oh, coach, can I at least just go through the movements? Nah, not allowed. To waste time.
But
I mean,
okay, all okay. Right, so well, let's go back.
So to answer the question, I'm obviously not a doctor or anything. My limited experience. Well, I mean, I guess like maybe I have more experience than some people in terms of injuries in jiu-jitsu, my limited medical knowledge, I would say, is that there's definitely a difference between injuries that are, like ligaments, tendons, muscular and bone, very different, you know. So ligaments and stuff, often you have issues with a whole bunch of scar tissue and stuff, and you have to do things safely and push into a little bit of pain to break scar tissue and things like this. Bone, though, typically once it's healed, it's healed. So when I broke my arm, the post-surgeon physio was like, the bone is not broken anymore. So you're going to feel like you need to like nurse this thing. You don't, man. Like it's good to go like it was pre breakage, like off you go. When I had my elbow surgery, I was given, strong, what are the, I'm just drawing a blank of the like opioid painkillers, right? Strong painkillers. Cause he's like, you need to do these certain exercises that are going to hurt like a motherfucker. So these painkillers are for you to take before you do the physio exercises, which are designed to break up, like think, cause otherwise you're going to have this, like this extra bone and stuff growing that you don't want to happen. Right. Like, so obviously depends on the injury and stuff, but from my understanding, and again, not a doctor, but from my understanding, if it's purely like bone, once you're told that bone is healed, you're good to go. You've just got to push through. We have a word for it in Portuguese. We call it receio, which is that like mental block where everything is fine, but you still have that like mental hesitation to do X, Y, Z because of past trauma. Obviously ligaments and stuff more complicated. The foot has a lot of bones and shit going on in the foot and ankle. So I don't know how complicated that gets, but, you know, I don't know, that's my understanding of it. And whether you're doing, we're not talking resistance training, no drilling, light drilling, whatever type of jiu-jitsu you're doing post-surgery, flow rolling, drilling with a grappling dummy, whatever you want to do, right? The number one priority is that it's with a partner you trust.
Yeah, I agree.
And again, it could be straight into rolling, whatever. Or yeah, again, resistance drilling or no resistance, whatever it is, even if it's no resistance drilling, like my first couple of days on the mats post-surgery, I'm never drilling even no resistance with someone I don't trust ever, right? Because it's like, especially because it's what I do for a job, for a career, like it's very important that like I don't have some spaz just do something because, yeah. So that would be my advice, man. Just make sure whatever type of jiu-jitsu you're doing, and what now as you're getting back on the mats, as long as you're with a trusted training partner, you just ramp it up from there. But this all has to come with, to some degree, the approval of your doctor. And what I mean by that is if most doctors, your average doctor had their way, we wouldn't do jiu-jitsu at all.
Yeah, we just choke those fuckers out.
Yeah. So as long as you trust your partner, man, just ramp it up from there.
That is sound, sensational advice. Only thing I would add, and this may not apply to you, Xavier, and this is just from personal experience. In my experience, whenever I've returned to the mats post-injury, I generally come back too early and go too hard. And particularly when you get a little bit of confidence, your drilling's all right. You know, you start doing specific training, you're doing all right. If everything's feeling great, and then you go back to full roles, like, you know, in 2 weeks earlier than you should, and you fucking injure it again. That's my experience. You know, I've never had to have surgery, thank God, yet. But you know, with ligament issues, strains, minor tears, ankles, shoulders, elbows, etc. It is my proclivity to come back too early and go too hard out of the gate. So maybe hold yourself back a little bit more than you would want to is what I've learned from that.
Yeah, good advice.
Okay, next question is we got another question from Aaron.
Hey guys, hope you're really well. This question is in relation to Shark Tanks. I'm just curious, what specifically are you trying to achieve whilst being Shark Tanked? Obviously, a lot of jiu-jitsu guys are using this when they're getting close to competition. You're seeing it in all the embedded, all the MMA guys are doing it close to their fights. What is actually happening? What are you trying to achieve? Is it muscular endurance? Is it sports-specific adaptations? Problem solving under fatigue? Or is it actually raising your cardiovascular system? And also, Kieran, I was hoping you could delve a little deeper into this to explain why. I'm sure Adam's got his theories as well.
So I'll let you take it first with the whole, guess he's talking about essentially cardio for jiu-jitsu. So I'll let you quickly take that one first, and then I'll give my thoughts.
You mentioned something really interesting, Aaron, that I've been wanting to talk about for a while and just trying to figure out how to approach it. I've heard other strength and conditioning coaches in the jiu-jitsu space mentioning this, and I think it's fucking spot on. MMA embeds. The intention behind MMA embeds, like the UFC embedded videos or MMA highlight, jiu-jitsu highlight reels or anything like that, is to look cool. It's to look fucking awesome. What looks awesome? Like an athlete dripping with sweat, doing some fucking hard shit, like, you know, punching the shit out of the boxing bag on the bottom, getting Shark Tank, you know, all that sort of stuff. What I'm trying to say is that style of training is what everyone thinks is really important for MMA, for jiu-jitsu, for whatever. But it doesn't make up the bulk of those athletes' training schedules, right? So what is also important is doing things like strength and conditioning, lifting weights, doing the boring stuff, the mobility work, everything like that. It's not all always focus on the stuff that you're going to see in MMA embedded. Now, let's talk about Shark Tanks, what their intention is. And I think Adam's probably going to talk to this point a bit more, is the intention behind a Shark Tank is to have fresh people come in and smash someone that's fatigued. So it's your ability to operate under fatigue, your ability to think under fatigue, your ability to withstand intensity when maybe you're fatigued. So it's all about pushing our limits when we're fatigued. Now, yes, there is going to be physical adaptations. There's always going to be physical adaptations when you put yourself through an intense training bout, even when it's sport, right? So yes, you are going to achieve some muscular endurance, VO2 max, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't necessarily think that is the intended purpose behind doing a Shark Tank. If you're doing Shark Tanks to try and get your athletes fitter, I don't necessarily think that is the most efficient way to get fitter, but it will condition you in other ways, right? Because it's specific adaptation to jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, and like as Kieran briefly touched on, from a jiu-jitsu point of view, not from an athlete point of view, yeah, there's multiple reasons why you Shark Tank. So you Shark Tank to, constantly have fresh people coming in. So you're replicating, like, what if in a match you're more tired than your opponent? You're sometimes replicating, like, we do a guard pass drill that's really punishing. You're replicating, like, turning the screws, cooking the beans, like, not cooking the beans, sorry, like, setting the intensity, setting the pace of the match right from the beginning. Sometimes you're replicating that, you know, man, there's 20 seconds left, you're down on points, like, you have to, you're trying to replicate that desperation. Yeah, and then the other things you said, like, operating under fatigue, like, you know, or sometimes it's just all psychological. Sometimes it's just doing something hard for the sake of it being hard for you to then feel like a badass and, like, you know, and get that psychological, like, you know, like, you know, to build resilience, like, you know, to get broken down a little bit. And so there's multiple reasons you do, you do Shark Tanks, and it depends how they're structured as to the specific goal that you're trying to achieve, you know? So, yeah, but like, I think any exhaustion pushing, specific training is really designed around, you operating under fatigue and building resilience. But yeah, sometimes it's specifically tailored around you having to blitz pass and, you know, or trying to develop that mindset of like, you're a shark and you've smelt blood in the water. Like, let's go. Like, you know, these things that when you see a really successful competitors do, they do, right? Like, you know, they see an opportunity and all of a sudden they're 0 to 100, right? Like, and they're all of a sudden moving like it's a 10-second round and,
yeah,
you know, they're pouncing on the opportunity, and Shark Tanks can help replicate that a little bit.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, great question.
Thanks, Aaron. All right, last question from David.
Yo, Kieran, Adam, love the show. Thanks very much. Keep it coming. My name is David. I'm a blue belt from Nottingham, training at Gracie Baja, Bakersfield. Massive shout out to those guys. My question is, what do you think is like jiu-jitsu's responsibility to build communities? Or if someone's a gym owner in a particular location, like maybe they're the only one in the town or the village or whatever, do they like have a responsibility to that community outside of just the gym? Like, do they have a responsibility to create a culture and, you know, I guess elevate the surrounding area, if that makes sense? Cool. Thanks, guys. Appreciate the show. Like I said, take it easy.
Very interesting question.
Very interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure how to approach that. In short, I guess my answer would be I don't know. and I think the answer, even if you knew the answer to the question, I think it would vary depending on whether your gym is in like quite a rural small town or if it's in like if it's in the downtown of a metropolis, you know, is going to be very, very different. You know, do you have a big kids program? Are you more adult focused? So all those things would kind of change the answer, but I don't know. I'll give you my gym, for example. Like, the culture and atmosphere in the gym is very friendly, very welcoming to everyone. And like, I think it could not be further from a toxic gym culture. I think it's a really good culture we have in the gym. I'm sure there'd be some people that would come through and say otherwise, but you can't please everyone. But I think as a whole, you know, it's a very well-cultured gym. But do I extend that to the wider community? Well, I mean, it's not like I actively seek out like and go do, you know, gym related, like I go find a charity that's in the area and do work through the gym for the charity because it's my responsibility or that I have a duty to do it. You know, the area that my gym in as well is like super, super, it's like the most Jewish part of Sydney. Like, and I'm not Jewish whatsoever. Like, you know, so I'm not like, it would almost feel like weird if I'm like trying to say that I have a duty to, you know, encroach on the Jewish community. I don't know. For me, it would seem weird to take that approach for where my gym is physically located. But I definitely, like, how do I say this? I have zero control of what my students do with their own time outside of the gym, right? Like, that is, it's their private life. They do whatever they want. Like, I would hope that they conduct themselves like civilized people in the society and the community that we live in. But, you know, they're free to do whatever they want. But to some degree, if I found out that one of my students behaved a certain way, like outside the gym, I perhaps would not want that person associated with my gym. And because it's not in line with the way that we carry ourselves in the gym as a functioning part of the community, even though we're not necessarily at the, you know, local parks tree planting day, but that's also due to it being in a city like Sydney. Like, you know, a town near where I grew up, if my gym was there, for argument's sake, that's a location that I could imagine you would partner with the local, you know, rural fire brigade to do some kind of thing, you know, on a particular day. Yeah. Or like, you know, but yeah, so I don't know. I know I'm a bit sort of vague, but I've never been asked that question before. And
yeah,
I think as a whole, it maybe, yeah, depends on, well, where is your gym? Like what community is it in?
David, I think this is a really, really good question, and it's definitely a lot of food for thought, like for an ethical thing, not just about jiu-jitsu, but about business, about small local business. What is your responsibility as a business owner to your community? And I think that, you know, you should absolutely have a responsibility to make a positive impact in that community. Like you said, Adam, what does that impact look like? Well, it depends on your business. It depends on your location. It depends on so many different factors. But let's assume that you did have a small, you know, a gym in a, you know, a rural area or whatever, or just whatever. Like, you're the only jiu-jitsu gym in town, I think is the example. What is your responsibility as the representative of jiu-jitsu in that local community? And I think that it does heighten the stakes. Like in Sydney, right? Just in your local area, Adam, how many jiu-jitsu gyms are within a 10-kilometer radius?
Like 10?
At least.
Like heaps, yeah.
More. I'd probably argue there's more. Like, anyway, the point is, like, if you are the sole representative of this martial art, then yeah, do you have more of a responsibility? Probably. I'd say probably, because you are the representative of the sport and you don't want to represent it poorly. Like Adam, like you said, if your members are, you know, starting fights at the pubs and using their jiu-jitsu to, you know, beat up kids at school or whatever, like, you know, that's not good. But where does that responsibility end? Because, you know, effectively you are a business. It is, you know, your job. So, I mean, the more I think about it, I'm just trying to like organize my thoughts as I spew out my word garbage here. I think that, yeah, you do have a responsibility to have a positive impact in your community as a business owner, not necessarily as a jiu-jitsu business owner, but as a business owner in general. And I've never had that question posed that way. And it's definitely something to think about. And I'd say yes.
I think you probably summed it up much better than I did. Yeah. I think you have a responsibility as a business owner, but then the question becomes, what does that responsibility look like? And the answer to that question comes with more questions, you know? Yeah. Like I said, we like conduct ourselves appropriately and everything, you know, at the gym, and, you know, we interact with all the people who come past the gym, in the gym, whatever. We do programs with some of the local schools in the area. I'm not out there being like, guys, I'm putting together this local free hugs, everyone loves each other day or whatever, community. Like, I don't know.
Well, maybe
like,
we should.
Yeah.
Maybe we should, Adam.
But yeah, I think as well, you have a responsibility as a business owner for sure to add to your community.
I think so. Yeah.
What does that responsibility look like? Well, depends. Interesting question.
I like that question a lot. And anyway. Well, thank you so much to everyone that submitted the questions. We had 7 people submit 8 questions with a double appearance from Aaron. Thanks, Aaron. He's always submitting really, really good questions as well. So thank you to everyone who submitted a question to this month's episode of the Ask a Black Belt. If you want to submit your question to the show, you can do so via our link tree, which you can find everywhere, or just go straight to the description of this episode and you can find the link. Hit submit a question to the show. You can do it straight from your phone. Audio questions is what we accept. And that's how to submit a question.
Yeah, guys, Adam, thank you.
Did you have something you wanted to share with the...
No, we were going to do our something interesting part, but we had so many questions. We're going to leave it focused more on the questions today. We'll be back to our usual format next week, where we'll have our something interesting at the end of the episode. I think we had enough stuff today, and my little something interesting wasn't even jiu-jitsu related. It was just something I read today. So I'll leave it. But yeah, guys, thank you so much for listening. Again, as Kieran said, you know where to go to submit your questions. But otherwise, we will see you next time. Thanks so much.
Bye.